broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Thank you so much for being with us. Obviously, we're tracking the biggest story the world over, and that's obviously the US elections. We'll get to other stories just now, but we wanted to just touch base with someone who will have a really great sense of what is happening on the ground. Executive Director of The City, a news outlet in New York, Nick Dawes, on the line with us. And Nick Dawes is quite familiar also to South Africa. So it's a really, really great to speak to you. Thank you so much for being with us. Good evening and welcome.
It's great to be back on Kaya after a very long time, and I'm embarrassed to be messing up Zoom already.
Not a problem at all. Give us a sense, Nick, where are you stationed at the moment?
I'm in New York City. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm at my office in the Financial District, but I came in from Brooklyn this morning, you know, past many people heading off to the polls.
It's about 4 hours to go until the first polling stations start to close. How has it been?
You know, there's... turnout seems to be really robust. A lot of people were able to vote early, vote in the days ahead of the election, either in person or by mail. And they did so in huge numbers. Here in New York, over 1 million people voted early. And there are lines today, which there aren't always in American elections. So there's a lot of participation, but people are also very, very anxious.
I believe there's already pre-election litigation cases underway. You know, what do you read into that?
Well, I think that these results, whichever way they go, are going to be fought out in two ways. One is, as you say, there are going to be court cases all across the country, if it's close, around which ballots should have been allowed and which shouldn't. The Republican Party has built up a whole machinery of election monitoring and legal response to do that. And the Democrats have their own capacity to answer those lawsuits and possibly file their own. And then the other thing is the, you know, the risk or the concern that there might be other kinds of contestation, including violence.
And I mean, are we likely to see, you know, if Donald Trump is not really ahead, a challenge from his side like before?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we've already seen a significant amount of misinformation about the voting in close states. Elon Musk has been in the forefront of distributing false claims about fraud and problems with the vote, and queuing people up to feel like any other result must only be the result of fraud. So there will definitely be legal challenges from that side. And, you know, we might also see, as we did last time, some of these groups going around to counting stations and claiming to monitor them, but really trying to intimidate them.
And how, in your sense, is the media covering the elections in the US?
Oh, it's all over the place. You know, there's been a lot of frustration among some people that the media has struggled to cover to convey the real stakes of this election, that it's very hard in the frame of normal political reporting to cover someone like Donald Trump, who seems to represent a threat to fundamental democratic values, who lies very freely. And if you treat him as a normal candidate, you can make him seem more sane and less threatening than he really might be. There are other people that just feel that it's impossible to trust any institution anymore, and that you have very partisan media, you have very right-wing media, Fox News and other outlets like it, and you have any media that is more traditional in its approach to these things, you know, is seen as being liberal. So these dynamics are familiar to South Africans who are used to debates about whom you should trust and whether the media represents one side or the other. But it's really accelerated to a much more urgent and worrying level. I think there's been some really great journalism done as well, however. Yeah.
I mean, it's a very close race. I'm not sure anybody can call it at this point. It's for us, looking from the outside in, seems very, very close. Let's talk a little bit about the swing states and what do you make of what could happen there?
Yeah, as listeners will know, this really isn't about the popular vote. It's about how people, about the counting up of electoral college votes in key swing states. And there are really seven of them. There are three that represent essentially the Midwest and the industrial heartland of the country. So that's Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If Kamala Harris wins all three of those, she will win the election. Pennsylvania really is the keystone. It has 19 electoral votes of the 270 that the winner will need to accumulate. And for both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, Pennsylvania is the keystone. They really need to win that. And that's why they ended their campaigns in Pennsylvania there. Yesterday.
Yeah.
Then there are the southern states, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada, if you like the Sun Belt states. Mm-hmm. Trump can win if he wins Georgia and Pennsylvania, for example.
Yeah.
For Kamala Harris, if she doesn't win Pennsylvania, she would need to pick up, you know, a number of those Sun Belt states. It's a more difficult path for her. They're closer, but it's not completely impossible. And there are some late signs in the polling that particularly women who are angry about abortion rights and who don't appreciate Trump's violent rhetoric may be turning her way, and that she may do better in those states than we expect. But it's very hard to be confident about any prediction right now.
Some of the difficulty emerges where it's not so much about Trump, but it's about the disappointment that people have with the Democrats who have been in power and feel, even though they may be Democrats themselves, but feel disappointed and feel like they really haven't lived up to what they promised. And so there's that nuance, isn't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, this has been a factor all over the world in recent election cycles, that people in elections since COVID have thrown out incumbent parties. We've seen it in multiple countries across Europe, but also elsewhere in the world, including South Africa. And those dynamics are very much in play here. People feel frustrated about the economy, even though unemployment is low, inflation is back under control, the economy is growing. People experience the fact that it's housing has become incredibly expensive. Mm. Grocery prices are still high. People mm-hmm. feel shut out and frustrated by that. People are anxious about crime, which spiked under COVID and is getting back under control, but they still feel anxiety around it. The same goes for migration in ways that are very similar to the politics around migration in South Africa. And so people are, really have a choice between responding to that disappointment by going for a candidate like Donald Trump, who says, I'm going to fix this by smashing the system. I'm going to smash the system and you can rely on me to, you know, deport thousands, millions even of migrants, put up big tariff barriers to keep out Chinese competition, lower taxes to unleash energy in the corporate sector. And a candidate who says, yes, I've been part of the system, but I'm going to fix it and I'm going to make it work better for you. And I'm going to enable you to continue to defend your rights in a democratic way. And particularly for women, I'm going to ensure that you have bodily autonomy and that you don't have a bunch of male politicians telling you how to take care of your reproductive health. So that's kind of the choice that people face in response to their frustration.
The world may be surprised at how the Muslim vote doesn't or is not responding, according to the polls, in the way that we expected it to respond to the Democrats, because we all are watching what's happening in the Middle East, and the idea of Muslims sort of being very democratic, or, you know, siding with the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans, would look like it's an obvious sort of decision and an obvious sort of choice. But I don't think it's that simple, is it, in the US at the moment?
It's not at all. And in fact, none of the ethnic voting blocks that people have traditionally taken for granted really lines up in a simple way anymore.
Yeah.
So from people that I've been speaking to, I hear people saying, I cannot vote for Kamala Harris because she has been complicit in genocide in Gaza. Mm. And then their choice might be to vote for a third party, the Green Party, which effectively will become a vote for Trump, or to not vote at all. Mm. I've heard other people say, well, no, I'm still going to vote for Kamala Harris because I think I'm going to have a better chance to put pressure on her and put pressure on a Democratic administration to do better. Mm. And that will be impossible under Trump. He's very close to Netanyahu. And he's very intolerant of dissent, and he's been he's had policies in the past that really discriminate against Muslims. And then there are other people in the Muslim community who support Trump not for reasons related to the Middle East, but because of conservative social policy, because they're concerned about sexuality, transgender rights, gay marriage, and those kinds of concerns. So this community is not monolithic at all.
And I guess it's the same for the Latino vote, which one would be surprised after hearing some of the utterances, and they still say, well, we're also very religious. We're against abortion. There are things about Trump that offend us, but actually, by and large, we'll stick with him.
A majority of Latinos will certainly still vote for Kamala Harris. And the shift towards Trump is mostly among Latino men frankly, you know, if you are concerned about Donald Trump, you can very well say that the problem is men. And, you know, some Latino men particularly, and women, but men more, are, you know, attracted to Trump's promise that he's machoness on the one hand, and also his promise to fix the economy.
Yeah.
And you can never tell when people talk about the economy if they really are thinking about the economy or if it's an excuse to prefer the machoness. You know, a lot of Trump has built a lot of support across the board among working class people, and the Democrats that used to be the party of the working class have lost a lot of working class support, and have become more and more the party of the professional classes and the urban classes. And so, you know, Latinos who are part of the working class have tracked that shift as well.
And I'm just curious why, you know, Biden's support for the working class, the truckers and all of that didn't really translate in that way for the Democrats.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. And I think part of it is a little bit of a question of time. Certainly that all of those initiatives that he's done on industrial policy, on rebuilding American manufacturing, have won him a lot of union support. And have been important in traditional industrial areas. So those blue wall swing states that we talked about, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, certainly, you know, support from the United Auto Workers, for example, has been very important. But I don't think that the message has yet gotten through broadly to people that Bidenomics really has moved the needle for American workers. Wages at the lower end of the scale have actually improved faster in the last 4 years than they have in the last 30 years. You know, the huge investments that he's making in, for example, silicon chip manufacturing and solar panel manufacturing, battery manufacturing in the U.S., they're still too new. They haven't really gotten through to the electorate yet. And it may be that people haven't been able to hear the message either because of the other weaknesses of Joe Biden as a kind of candidate at the beginning. But that's that many Democrats are wringing their hands about why are the vibes so against us when we've actually had such a successful economic policy program in relation to blue collar jobs and manufacturing.
I'm almost afraid to frame it this way, but could we also just bring it down to star quality? You know what I mean? So you hate him or like him, but this is a man with some presence, and whether he lies or he tells the truth, he's got something, that thing that maybe, you know, Kamala Harris doesn't have.
I think there's no question that Donald Trump's star quality has been a factor throughout his rise. And, you know, if you want to think about the role of the TV show The Apprentice in making him and in establishing his myth, because he wasn't a great businessman. You know, he wasn't, you know, he got a lot of money from his dad. In some ways, he arguably
and lost a lot of it too.
Badly.
Yes. Yeah.
He lost a lot of it. Yeah. Went bankrupt multiple times.
Yeah.
But that established the myth of this guy who is a real businessman, who has charisma. He's also very good at manipulating people's attention. He understands the attention economy and the digital economy of attention super well. And it didn't help having a president who was quite successful from a policy perspective, but who was really increasingly elderly and who struggled with communication. Kamala Harris has only had a few months to establish herself. And if you think about the fact that, you know, she's gone from underwater to pretty popular and neck and neck at worst in just 3 months, that's quite an amazing performance. And Trump's star quality comes with negatives as well, because he's out there, you know, he called Kamala Harris a B-I-T, and then he stopped finishing it and the crowd chanted. Those are the negative sides of his star quality, which also manifests. But it's a huge factor.
So what is, let's start with Donald Trump. What does Donald Trump's win mean for South Africa, or better yet, the continent? Because there is a nuance here. What he has said about us, and we all know what he has said about us, an hole. In actual fact, his policies were not that bad for us, actually, when you compare him to maybe his predecessors.
I think there are a number of lenses you can see them through, see this through. Some people, I think, on the continent and, you know, also in South Asia and other places say, well, you know, a more isolationist America, America that meddles less in world affairs is good for us. I'm not sure that that's right. I think there are a few ways that he poses a risk. One is that he is very protectionist on trade. And, you know, even more so than the Democrats are now. And I think you could see some, particularly if there's a Republican-controlled Congress, I think you could see some risks to AGOA. There's already pressure to, for example, kick countries out of AGOA who don't line up with U.S. policy on Israel. And that could increase, I think, under a Trump administration. The other thing is climate change and climate finance. Having a president in the U.S. who denies the reality of climate change and who certainly doesn't think that the global north should be funding a just energy transition in Africa will both reduce the resources that are available to South Africa and other countries in the region to build new energy systems. And it will allow climate change to accelerate and affect the region in a very, very differentially tough way. And I think you'll also see almost certainly the cutting off of funding for reproductive health care and women's health on the continent, because they will implement what they call the global gag rule. So there are a bunch of specific things like that that I think will be very bad for the continent, even if people are like a little bit relieved to have a less imperial or preening U.S. in their backyard.
Although Obama wasn't that great for the continent, so do you think Harris will be better?
I don't know. I don't think either. I don't think we should believe from any of them a rhetoric of real partnership with African countries. I think you see a U.S. that is more focused at home. And you see U.S. voters that are very, very focused on their own interests. But I think that Harris will be better than Trump. Will she be better than Obama, you know, without direct roots on the continent? I don't know. You know, her parents are very interesting. You know, her father is a very well-known left-wing Jamaican economist. And, you know, her mother is originally from India, and they were part of a whole flowering of the relationship between left African-American politics and internationalism and non-alignment. She doesn't seem to have inherited that politics. But I suppose I harbor some faint hope that there might be some memories of that tradition. Her foreign policy advisor is a very pragmatic, centrist kind of a guy. And I think that one thing that'll be interesting to see is that the Biden administration initially put a lot of pressure on African countries that weren't aligned with their approach to Ukraine, and particularly with their approach to Russia. And then they had to back off and say, well, you know, countries like South Africa, just as countries like India, need to have their own sort of third way. I suspect that she would continue with that more flexible approach. I think Trump is more going to be more inclined to punish countries that disagree with the U.S.
Really fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much, Nick. You know, all the best, and hopefully we'll catch up with you soon again.
That was really fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much. That's Nick Dawes coming through to us live in New York. He's an executive director of The City. It's a news outlet in New York. And he's been in South Africa as an editor. So he knows his way about here as well. Well, we couldn't do this without catching up with our colleague, Gugu Mfupi, who is right now in Minneapolis in Minnesota. She's been up since the crack of dawn. Gugu, thank you so much for making time for us. Hello, and how are you?
Oh, I must tell you, it's chilly out here in the town of Minneapolis. It's about 7 degrees Celsius. It's overcast. It's raining. It's damp. It's the kind of weather that one would actually prefer to spend indoors. Mm. But given the hype and the vibrancy and excitement that sits over all cities in the United States, I must tell you, I certainly couldn't be indoors. So I'm probably at my third voting station for the day. Mm-hmm. We started about a good 4 hours ago. And so far, things appear to be going swimmingly well for many Americans who have made their way to the polls.
We were told that in some states, you know, you can already see the FBI out and about. There's an excited tension in the air and, you know, people just making sure that things go smoothly. What does it look like on the ground where you are?
I must tell you, Minneapolis is a very unique part of the country. Here out in the Midwest, where it's a lot calmer and quieter, but more so the state of Minnesota itself is actually known to be a very blue state. The last time they actually elected a Republican president was back in 1972, where they voted in favor of President Nixon at the time. Since then, it's been known to be blue, but more so, it also is the home ground advantage of Tim Walz, who is the vice presidential candidate, I beg your pardon, for the Democrats in this year's election. So I'm in a part of the world that's very calm. Mm. I've seen minimal drama to activity and conflict that's taken place, and one that is also very liberal to such an extent that many of the Democratic supporters are very vocal. They wear their T-shirts. They're very expressive about wanting to see change and voting for Kamala Harris. And it's usually in the more isolated parts of town that you find Republican supporters. But there are Republican supporters who have a presence here too, but perhaps are just a lot more quieter and perhaps even ashamed, shy, embarrassed, but prefer not to be very vocal or outspoken about their alignment or allegiance to the Republican Party. And I guess the complexities that come with aligning themselves with Donald Trump as well.
You know, Nick Dawes, who was talking to us from New York, was saying that, well, he has noticed the number of people who've come out. Now, unlike us, people have had lots of time to vote before today, but the in-person voting, he says, well, their queues, which is quite unusual in the US. Are people coming out in their numbers in Minnesota?
Indeed. From what I've been witnessing, the voting stations actually have a very seamless process, one that also allows voters to register on the same day as voting. So as long as you're able to prove that you are a resident of the particular town, state or county that you're representing or from, and able to identify yourself adequately, you are able to register and then submit your vote. I haven't witnessed any long queues. If anything, it's been a maximum of 10, 12, maybe 20 people in a queue. But given the efficiency of the operators here, as well as the electoral council and the judges who are involved, it's actually gone very, very well. Lots of activity. I must tell you, I've been in different parts of town, from more suburban areas, now out in the southern part of Minnesota, in Minneapolis, I beg your pardon, which is slightly more diverse. I'm seeing a lot more Hispanic and Mexican supporters come out. So very interesting to see the diversity in terms of race, culture, creed, backgrounds, and gender that has also been coming out to the polls so far.
And on the ground, what do people, because obviously, you know, the Democrats, you know, have been talking about what's important to them, you know, what the Republicans have also been saying, and the issues of, you and I spoke the other day, of the economy, of abortion and so on, have been top of agenda. But on the ground, for people who are coming out, what's most important to them? What do they want to see happen?
What I found to be very interesting is, of course, the stance of young females who are coming to the fore. And that's right across the racial spectrum, but more so maybe white, young, educated females who are a lot more liberal in their views. And that's largely because of Roe versus Wade. There's a growing cohort of women who are actively calling for advancements in terms of their reproductive rights and wanting to have a say in terms of how they would actually like to see the rules and regulations around abortion controls come to the fore. Many young black men, on the other hand, have actually highlighted the fact that they feel excluded from the economy. And whilst they might not necessarily agree with the politics of either candidate, Trump or Harris, they do highlight that they have a stronger leaning towards Donald Trump because they view him, I guess, as an enigma, as a man who says what he says wholeheartedly, very boldly and confidently, no matter how controversial it might seem. But they do trust in his leadership capabilities more than they view that of Kamala Harris. There's also a concern from some members of the African American community and Latin American community who still feel excluded by the Democrats, essentially highlighting that for years they've continued to support them, but haven't really seen any significant shifts in policy that have translated into a quote-unquote better outcomes or way of living for people of color. And I must say, having spoken to, I guess, more senior white American men, there's a strong level of patriotism that comes through, patriotic towards America, many of whom have relatives and older parents who might have served in the armed forces. So they're very clear in terms of being aligned to the Republican Party, but have raised concerns once again around the personality that is Donald Trump. So varying views, and I must say it really differs from the experiences that I've had in the other states, be it D.C., New York or Miami, and even in Arizona, where there's a heightened level of debate and contrasting views regarding the political outcomes and political leanings that average Americans have in comparison to the Midwest, which is known to be a lot more democratic and liberal in certain states.
We're going to leave it there, Gugu. You've got a long day ahead of you, so we'll keep in touch. Thank you so much, Gugu Mfuphi, coming to us live from a voting station in Minneapolis in Minnesota.
And if you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.